Lots to talk about with Richard C. Hoagland. Want to get his take on the International Space Station, this Rosetta mission, comets, just everything out there in space. It's fascinating. Later on, next hour, perhaps we'll take your phone calls with Richard Hoagland here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Richard C. Hoagland with us. Richard, any tours or conferences coming up for you?
Actually, when you're writing books, you don't get a chance to do much traveling and flitting around and all the cool stuff that Robin and I do when we're not doing books. By the way, I want to make one small correction. I tried to give out Charlie Lewis's website a few minutes ago.
Yeah, what?
And I got it wrong. So everybody get a pen, get a paper. It's http://HEAE.biz /. That's http://HEAE.biz as in zebra, /.
Why don't you email that? Email it to Lex and I'll have him Twitter it for you.
Exactly.
Too.
I will put it on an email to Lex. And the reason this is relevant is that what Charlie is doing is in the energy area, what Musk is doing in the rocket area, and what Sir Richard Branson is doing. Do you know, George, I've got one of your affiliates up in Alaska which wants to do a Kickstarter campaign to raise $200,000 to put me into Branson's spaceship?
Would you go?
Of course. I mean, these problems are going to fix. I'm not going to authorize them to do anything. What?
He's got some technical issues. I think he needs a little more.
So they'll solve them. Remember, you and I are old enough to have seen the incredible history of the first age of space. Remember those images?
We've seen it all. We have been there since Sputnik, Richard.
Yes, and remember all the rockets' red glare that went down and not up and sideways and not up and toward the control blockhouse, not up?
That's right.
It all gets fixed. If you put enough money and enough engineering talent in this day and age in an engineering problem, it will be solved. Look at Elon Musk. Look at the incredible. I mean, they're quoting him only a 50-50 shot at successfully landing his first Falcon 9 rocket back on that sea platform on Friday. I would say it's more like 70 or 80%. Musk does not do something in public until he's really got it nailed. And maybe the first one won't work, but I'll bet you the second one will. So, yeah, Branson and the company will fix the problems with the Enterprise, which, by the way, did you know that was the name of Branson's spaceship?
No, I didn't know that.
The folks are going to go up in?
Well, that would be perfect for you then.
Exactly. And remember, it's not an orbital flight. It's suborbital.
Right. You go up and you come down, right?
Yeah. Frankly, when I saw the accident, George, I was looking at sabotage. Because there's no way that the pilot, in his right frame of mind, who had not been, I'll use the term, mind-controlled, would flip that lever and unleash the locks on the feathering mechanism while they're still in upward-powered flight. That's nuts. That's insane.
Yes.
Unless he had some subliminal hypnotic suggestion to do that, so that Branson doesn't get to do what he does, and all us civilians that want to get up there and see what we can see don't get to fly and see what we can see because we can't be controlled. Now, again, this is a speculation. This is a scenario. But no rocket pilot or engineer in his right mind would have pulled that lever and released the locking mechanism before the damn system was going to be used. And we have video of this pilot doing that on camera, and unfortunately, he died, so we'll never know why. But I just was very suspicious, because if you've been keeping secrets for decades, 50 years, 100 years about what's really out there, the last thing you want is a whole bunch of uncontrollable private enterprise entrepreneurs like Elon Musk, like Sir Richard Branson, like Bezos, like all the others, going places where no one has gone and spilling the beans when they're stunned by what they find when they get there. So we're at the dawn, George, of a second age that's going to make the first age pale into almost insignificance because of the riches and the treasure and the knowledge and the benefit to human beings that this unfettered competitive access is going to unleash in a wave of exploration and ultimately colonization of our heritage, as Kraft Eric used to tell me. He called the solar system our magnificent heritage, and unfortunately he died before I could prove to him just how damn magnificent it really is and all the things that are waiting for us to utilize for our epoch of civilization to change with a trend curve from down to up.
Can you imagine, though, Richard, how much that you and I have seen, what we've witnessed since the dawn of the space age? I mean, the original seven astronauts, Sputnik, everything. We have seen it all.
Remember Echo?
Yep.
This 100-foot-mile-hour balloon inflated in space with a small recorder attached to it, and as it sailed around the world, they bounced radio signals off it like a mirror, and they were able to get the first transatlantic non-HF frequency broadcast.
That's right.
By bouncing radio signals off the Echo balloon satellite.
Would have been great
and
to have had
and
our
on,
show
the
there.
Tyros, the worst first weather pictures, Mariner 4, as I write about in the Pluto book, the first Mars shot that went past and took 22 photographs, and it took them days, George, at 8.5 bits per second. 8.5. Not 8,000, not 80,000, not 8 million, 8.5 bits per second to transmit those first images of Mars that July night back to Earth. Over weeks it took them to store and transmit and record all those 22 images, yet they're part of history now.
But they did it.
They did it. Well, that kind of entrepreneurship, which was in NASA, in the glory days, in the so-called golden age of exploration, is going to be magnified 100, 1,000 times as you release the pent-up energies of the private sector while you have a professional space program managed by the government, like the Army and Marines and the Navy, to have a space force worthy of the name. So in terms of destinations and projects that all of us should share, because, of course, private enterprise is going to want to go and put a price tag on everything it finds, right?
That's right.
Can you imagine ruins at Sedonia going to the highest bidder at Sotheby's?
Somebody like Musk would buy it.
Well, Musk wants to get us off Earth. In fact, I learned something really, really cool about Elon Musk the other day. Do you remember the story that was floated a few days ago about what got him into space in the first place? What triggered his whole idea of doing all these amazing technical things and making sure that the human race lives on more than one planet by the time he leaves this one?
He's obsessed with it, isn't he?
Yes, but why was he obsessed? He revealed why.
Why?
Because he read a book. In fact, he read three books. Isaac Asimov's Foundation Trilogy. Remember Foundation? Foundation and Empire. And Second Foundation, the names of the three books. Well, in that trilogy, Isaac Asimov limbed out a future galactic civilization which went into a dark age with tyranny and suppression and anti-democratic things all over the galaxy. And this small institution, this foundation, founded by a genius political science expert named Harry Seldon, who produced something called the Seldon Curve, which allowed Isaac to create in fiction the idea that you could project ahead enough history to where you would realize that at some future point, democracy and civilization would rise anew in the galaxy, and the foundation was set up to be ready when that time came to move the history curve in a different direction from the dark, despotic saga that we saw reiterated in the Star Wars sequels. I mean, I guarantee you George Lucas read the same, you know, trilogy that Elon Musk is admitting to now, and that's in part where we got Star Wars, you know, galactic empire, evil, you know, emperors clamping down on small democratic lights in the galaxy until the no light was left unextinguished. That's straight out of Isaac Asimov. Well, if Elon is listening tonight, when I was beginning my professional space career back in the museum in Springfield, way back in the dim prehistory of the space age, the first space age, I met, because I wanted to and I demanded to, and I called him up and I eventually was able to meet Isaac Asimov and become friends. In fact, we became such good friends that he would go around and publicly claim that everything that I knew, I got from him. I even got him to go on a cruise on the Queen Elizabeth II to the last Apollo mission to the moon, where we anchored offshore on the USS Stottendam, and they launched that sucker into the night sky at night, the first night launch of a Saturn V, and Isaac wrote this amazing story in the Playboy magazine called The Cruise and I, where he described how I conned him into going on this ship, because he, for all the futuristic stuff that Asimov wrote about and lived, he was terrified of leaving his apartment in New York City. He was an agoraphobe. He was a tried and true agoraphobe, and I got him out of that apartment and onto a ship in the middle of the South Atlantic to watch this amazing night launch. And in his novel, you know, of the Foundation series, he basically is describing a future which will happen to us unless, as Musk is now definitely internalized, we do something radically different. We export the human race from one planet back to the rest of the system that we used to inhabit, and we retake command of our extraordinary history. And Musk technology is one of the leading ways we're going to do it, and we're going to see another data point on Friday when he lands that rocket back on that platform successfully, I believe, for the first time.
Well, let's hope he does. What's going on with the Europeans these days? They've got this successful Rosetta mission going, even though the Comet lander landed in a shadow and that kind of killed its batteries. But that was a pretty good job.
Well, actually, that's not exactly the way it happened. The little Philae lander, which they set down on, I think it was November 12th is when they landed. It actually landed three times. It bounced. And then it bounced again, because the harpoons that were supposed to fire and anchor it to the surface when the computer received the touchdown signal, for some reason they didn't fire. And so it bounced back up to over 1,000 feet, took 2.5 hours to slowly coast back down. It then bounced again, and finally it ended up someplace on the comet that they can't find. They've been taking reconnaissance imagery, high-resolution imagery, with the orbiter, the Rosetta orbiter mothership, which is in this very long, loose orbit. It takes a couple weeks to go around once, because the gravity field of this little comet, 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, henceforth tonight, just 67P, George, right? Right.
You got it. That's right.
This little guy, 2.5 miles across, has essentially no gravity. So the Philae spacecraft came gently sailing down out of the dark that November 12th afternoon at 1 meter per second. That's 3 feet per second descent over a 7-mile fall from something like 30 miles out to land at 1 meter per second and to bounce, because the spacecraft, which actually weighed a little over 200 pounds, about the size of a washing machine, weighs 200 pounds, full of all kinds of really cool electronic instruments and sensors and analysis equipment and all that.
It should have smashed, right?
Well, no, because it's only landing at 3 feet per second. I mean, the Orion spacecraft that NASA tested last week,
yeah,
and dunked in the ocean on parachutes, it came down at 20 feet per second, not 3 feet per second. And that's survivable by a human being in an acceleration couch. So, no, for the equipment, it simply touched the legs, the spring legs, the tripod legs deformed. They then sprang back and bounced it back up to over 1,000 feet, because the gravity is so tiny on 67P, that even sitting on the surface now, wherever little Philae is in that dark, shadowed corner where it wound up after the bounces, it only weighs about 1 gram.
Now, it's dead now, though, isn't it?
No. It had two sets of batteries. It had a 65-hour disposable battery, like a big lead-acid battery in your car.
Right.
Only it wasn't lead-acid. It was something more sophisticated, probably nickel hydrogen or something like that. And then it had a rechargeable battery, which allows it to use solar energy and recharge and run the instruments, provided it sees about 6 hours of sunlight every day.
But it's not getting that, is it?
What?
It's not getting that.
Hang on. Where it landed, it was only getting about 1.5 hours of sunlight per day.
Okay.
And that wasn't enough to, when the big battery was discharged, that small battery couldn't recharge fast enough, given that Philae is on 67P, and 67P is halfway between Mars and Jupiter, where sunlight is about one quarter as strong as it is here on Earth. As the little robot sitting there in the dark in hibernation, it's not dead, George, it's simply hibernating.
Hibernating.
As it receives daily more and more solar energy because the comet is getting closer to the sun, and the angle between the spin axis of the comet and where Philae is on the comet and where the sun is in the comet's sky is changing because the seasons are changing for the comet, just like seasons change for us here on Earth with our 25-degree tilt. Eventually, they're now saying, maybe by January or February, it's going to come back to life and be able to store enough energy daily to give reports, to do experiments, you know, and it could last a lot longer than they originally projected, because wherever it is, tucked up against a big wall with a shadow, it will keep it cooler as the comet approaches the sun. Ultimately, it'll be about the same distance, excuse me, from the sun as Mars is in its elliptical orbit.
That would be exciting.
And at that
point,
all kinds of activity is going to be going off, you know, geysers of material, jets of stuff, you know, pieces of whatever the surface is that's tumbling off and being blasted away into space. And little Philae is going to be there, awake again with a full battery charge, all its instruments working. So we're going to have two viewpoints as this thing warms up and does its outgassing thing, and we learn tons about what this object is really made of and what it's doing from two observation points. The little Philae lander on the surface, which will come back to life after hibernation, and the Rosetta orbiter, which is in this two-week orbit, narrowing as they move it within just 4 or 5 miles during the interesting parts of the coming encounter with the sun, so they can study from space and from the surface how this object responds. And, of course, the bottom line for all of our research is they're sitting on and looking from orbit at not a comet, but from everything now we've been able to put together, they're looking, George, at an ancient derelict spacecraft. And the outgassing they're seeing is not that pieces of it are melting. It's that the remaining tanks of environmental, you know, fuel and oxygen and water and all the other things required to keep a population of millions of people alive in a spacecraft in a closed environment is now leaking into space every time it comes close enough to the sun to where it warms up enough and the water vaporizes in a vacuum and turns into a gas. And that's what is being measured by these two spacecraft as they encountered the first comet that anyone has landed on in the modern history of the solar system. And if you look at the pictures...
Wait. You're saying that this is not a comet, but it's an old spaceship, like a mothership?
Yep. It's about 2.5 miles across. It's either a habitat, like a super space station, you know, a workplace where millions of people lived and worked and did all kinds of things, or it was some kind of a spacecraft, probably some kind of a government kind of spacecraft, because it's huge and that kind of resources is probably only available to governments even way back when this thing was built. But we won't know any of that unless we actually land something on it and find libraries.
I want to find out from you when we come back why you believe it could be an ancient spaceship. And by the way, our friend Charles Lewis emails me about your plans to maybe go into space. He says, I'm not in favor of that at all. It has to be far better developed. We'll be back. Welcome back. Richard C. Hoagland with us. Richard, do you sing?
Well, I used to.
That's what I hear. We should have had you on this. We should have had you on the CD. I'm doing a little Christmas song.
I was actually on Columbia Records with my brothers and sisters. We had a group back in the 60s and 70s called the Foregone Conclusion.
I love it.
you can see how optimistic I was.
That was so
well,
cool.
Well, we actually, you know, I wound up singing on The Tonight Show for Johnny.
You're kidding me.
No. And they erased the tapes, George.
Oh.
Huge conspiracy.
It is a conspiracy. What'd you sing?
Well,
do you remember? Did you have a band there and everything?
A sketch, of course.
Cool.
It was a song you have never heard called Dorothy Hermesheimer.
I've never heard of that.
If they hadn't destroyed those tapes, there would be video of me. This was the night that we first landed on the moon with Surveyor. And I had come down from the museum in Springfield with a friend of mine from high school just to kind of, you know, pal around New York and see the sights and play tourists and all that. And I dropped into NBC because I had made some friends over there. And when one of the friends said, would you like to go up and see what they're doing in Studio 8H? I said, sure. So we went up in the elevator. That was the big studio. That's where the Today Show originated from. It's one up from where the Tonight Show originated and all that. Anyway, you're in New York, at Rockefeller Center, Radio City Music Hall. We go upstairs, and I find that they're setting up to do live coverage. This was June 2nd, 1966, George. Talk about remembering everything. And they were about to land this unmanned robot, Surveyor, on the moon for the first time. I mean, this was huge for us back then because
we hadn't
very many successes, and the Russians were doing all kinds of really cool things, and we were sitting there saying, oh, why can't we do something cool? Well, this was the night JPL was going to try after huge monetary and technical problems and congressional hearings and all kinds of other stuff that I was following even back then. They were going to try to land this thing, and so I'm walking around the studio with my friend Bruce, and I notice they're hanging the moon. And the guy in charge... Well, they have to build a set, right?
Right. Yeah.
So they're hanging the moon, one of these big, huge, you know, fiberglass Rand McNally moons that you've seen in museums, you know, all around the world now. It's a 3D relief moon, colored and all that, really cool for pre-space age, you know, work. And they're hanging it, and the guy directing them is a guy named Dr. Frank Fields. Remember Dr. Frank?
I remember Frank Fields. He was one of the executive producers for NBC.
He was the Channel 4 producer because I was not at CBS. It was NBC where I was hanging out, right?
That's right.
So I'm watching them hang the moon, and I say to Bruce, gosh, I wonder if I should say something. And he says, what? I said, they're hanging it upside down. So I marched over to Frank Fields, and I basically said, Dr. Fields, you don't know me. Introduced myself. I was curator of astronomy at the museum in Springfield. I come down. I was doing kind of a busman's holiday. Oh, and I noticed you're hanging the moon upside down. He says, what? Rushes over, corrects it, then comes back to me and said, how would you like to work for us tonight? That was my first network consulting job on the first unmanned landing on the moon, June 2nd, 1966, and I remember it as clear as I remember our last show.
That's a great story. He was also a meteorologist, I think.
He's still a meteorologist.
He's still alive, Richard. He's 91 years old.
And he's still around. He was at WNBC.
Yeah. Yep.
And
that's
he
right.
was very different. You know, he did these... For television of that era, it was very innovative. He tried to make science and weather interesting to people
and
who only wanted to know if they get to work without an umbrella.
He was like Mr. Wizard almost.
He was like, he kind of did a Mr. Wizard thing. Anyway, so we never told anybody except till tonight that they were going to hang the moon upside down. But that's what got me into network television for NBC that night. And I must tell you that of the two networks that I worked for in that era, CBS and NBC, because CBS came later, I much preferred CBS. NBC was too regimented. It was too, you know, we've got to follow the script. I mean, I barely got the moon hung right side up because everybody objected. This skinny kid out of nowhere tells them they're hanging the moon upside down. Give me a break. But, of course, it was accurate.
I would have loved seeing you on the Ed Sullivan Show. right here on our stage, Richard Hoagland, and singing the Dorothy Hamersimer song.
If somebody at NBC can find the tape, you will see me singing to Johnny and inviting him to our all-night surveyor party after the Tonight Show.
One of my dear friends, Frank Accarino, retired about a year ago from NBC. He was their vice president of television. He would have found that tape for us. He would have gone down in the basement and found that tape.
Well, you know, NBC has put a whole bunch of tapes in storage in a Utah salt mine where the rest of the archives are located in case something really disastrous happens to the planet.
Right.
But that particular tape, when I tried to do some looking a few years ago, they think they taped over it. Like the claim is that NASA, when it didn't have much money in the interim years, it retaped over a whole bunch of very expensive high-end Ampex videotapes, including the original tape of the Apollo 11 moonshot landing that night.
One-inch videotape.
One-inch video. Well, actually, this was two-inch.
Two-inch. Oh, that's really old.
The big ones. Old.
Big ones.
But maybe somewhere, someone has a copy of that Tonight Show, in which case I can be embarrassed coast to coast.
I would put it on our website if somebody can find it. I would do that. Anyways, back to this Comet 67P that you call a derelict spaceship. How do you know this?
Just by looking at it.
What do you mean just by looking at it? It looks like a potato to me.
Hang on. Carl Sagan, decades ago when he was writing his first major book, Cosmos, and he was involved in the primitive Tyros satellite program. Remember Tyros, the first weather satellite?
Yeah.
Which had cameras and infrared cameras, and they took pictures. Well, Carl went through thousands of primitive weather satellite black and white images. This is before we went to Mars and all that. Looking for evidence on satellite imagery of the presence of a civilization here on Earth, human beings. And he only found out of thousands of these primitive satellite images taken back in, I think it was 66, 67, he only found two that showed unmistakable evidence of human habitation of Earth. And we know, of course, that Earth is teeming with life, right? Two pictures.
Right.
One was of the Great Wall in China, looping over the hills, long, straight, geometric, straight lines do not easily form in nature, or straight lines with right angles coming off them don't form in nature. And the other was a cross-hatched logging road system in a forest in Canada where the snow had just fallen and the roads were white and the forest, because it had been a cold snow, not a wet snow, but a cold snow, the snow hadn't stuck to the trees, so you had dark trees over a cross-hatched like checkerboard pattern because of the snow on the logging roads in the forest. So it looked like a little tic-tac-toe game from orbit, from space. And that was what led him to coin his very famous pronunciation that intelligent life on Earth first manifests itself in the geometric regularity of its constructions. So if you're an amateur archaeologist, an amateur space archaeologist, looking at all these amazing images coming back from all these various space programs, the Europeans, NASA, the Chinese, the Indians, the Japanese, whatever, if you're looking for evidence of ancient civilization elsewhere in the solar system, what you want to look for is what Sagan prescribed decades ago. You're looking for geometry. So what I want you to do now is I want you to go to the pictures we've got up on the COAST website, courtesy of Lex, and go to picture number one. Figure number one. You got it?
All right.
It's a black and white. This is taking us back to Mars briefly, kind of a detour on the way back to the comet. This is a picture that was released a few days ago officially by NASA of a roughly mile-wide circular structure, object, lying in a field of lava, the only thing like it for hundreds of miles around. And it appears to look kind of like a half-eaten waffle. You see in the lower left-hand corner of the picture those incisions, and it's obviously raised like an old waffle. You see that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Look at the inset in the upper right corner of that composite. What do you see?
Well, what does it look like to you?
Well, do you see that bright white line stretching diagonally across the enlarged inset?
Yeah.
You see it against the shadows?
What is that?
Exactly. What is that? I can show you an identical image that looks awfully similar of an object, you know, like 20 or 30 miles away from me. It's called the Sandia Tram. And when you take a Google picture, everybody can rush to Google and Google Albuquerque and find the Sandia Tram. You know, you use map and satellite views and you'll zoom in on it. That's what this thing looks like taken from the MRO camera, the NASA camera in the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft a few days ago. Looking down at this structure, there are three gossamer-like, perfectly straight, bright lines extending over this other ancient object looking like a, you know, a half-eaten waffle about a mile across lying there in the Martian deserts. That bright line, George, appears to be a tramway, a tram line, a cable car line. I mean, think of the logic. If it was a fault on the surface, then all those shadows that cross it, you shouldn't see it because it's not being lit by sunlight, right? Hmm. So whatever it is, it has to be high enough to clear the relief underneath and to be in sun, even though the ground under it is dark because it's hidden from the sun by the shadows of the structures in this circular thing, whatever the thing is.
How long do you think that line goes?
Well, we know it's about half a mile long. And it's only one of three. There are three on this thing. So when I finish the article, the in-depth paper I was writing that I hope to get up on the Enterprise website for tonight, and unfortunately a last-minute problem with the Pluto book forced me to do work on that to get it ready for publication and the final proofs at the end of the week. So I couldn't finish the paper on this and the comet that I'm going to be putting up on Enterprise, but I will in the next few days finish it and put it up there with the analysis. These three lines at three slightly different angles are not scan lines. They're not fault lines. There's nothing in nature that could create half-mile-long lines, and because the photograph was not taken looking straight down, but kind of tipped at an angle slightly sideways, You're looking, I mean, it looks as if you're looking straight down on the picture because you have no references.
Right.
But if you actually
right.
go back to the original data that NASA publishes with every photograph it takes, that angle between the camera and the spacecraft and the surface of Mars is about 10 or 15 degrees. So there's a tilt. And if you put a straight edge along that line, you'll see that it's very gently curved. It's not straight. It's slightly curved, meaning you're looking at a sagging physical cable producing what's called a catenary curve because of gravity. And the Mars gravity is about a third of the Earth's gravity, so there's real significant gravity on Mars. And this ancient cable system, three of them, is fanning out across the center of this feature, this structure, as if a later civilization on Mars had built tourist cable cars to go and take people back and forth to look at this ancient ruin from a much earlier epoch in Mars history with a later civilization, which of course also is now gone. So in one shot, in one image, we see a stunning panorama of an incredible ancient era of building on a scale that's pretty hard for us to imagine. Then you flash forward the hypothetical film to whoever built the cable cars, and now they're gone, and in the thin Martian air and in the lack of oxygen and the lack of corrosion, those lines, those tram lines, which could be meters thick, each one of them supporting a cable car system, just like the tram here in Albuquerque. That tramway system is still living on Mars, even though everything else is gone, and it's new testimony to the kinds of technology and extraordinary knowledge of later civilizations that are just there for the asking if we or the government or Musk or Bezos or any of these people who are now creating the competitive private-public space efforts launched the second age of space by finding out what our ancestors left for us to change the world so that we live and do not die as if we will if we are imprisoned on one world.
What if that's a bridge? Or is it too small to be a bridge?
It's too small to be a bridge. The resolution of these images is on the order of meters. So we're talking about a cable, and we're talking about by the way, when you look carefully at the three cables.
And that's on Mars. We're looking at the picture on Mars.
This is on Mars.
All right.
This is close to the equator of Mars. And if you look at the three, the middle one is the brightest because the sun angle between the sun, the cable, and the camera. Like any other mirror, you know, angle of reflection equals angle of incidence, that kind of thing. So you've got three cables, two of which are dimmer because the angle, even across that small mile circle, is different enough that the sensor in the MRO camera was picking up significantly less light from the two on the outliers, you know, left and right, as opposed to the one in the middle. And if you look really carefully at the enlargement, you'll be able to see that there seems to be surface installations anchoring it. There appears to be some kind of a building with windows at the top of where it's anchored in the center of the ancient ruin, just like you'd put a tram in any other tourist location and ferry tourists back and forth to see the sights, being able, like at Disneyland, you can take a cable car and cross Disneyland, the park, from, you know, several feet in the air, 20, 30 feet, right? This looks like an ancient version of that, which if it's real, and I can't think of any physical reason why it's not what we think it is, it's telling us a tremendous amount about the civilization that built it. And what's the most important thing it's telling us, George, about this later civilization just from looking at a cable car tram line? It's telling us that whoever built the later stuff did not have anti-gravity. They had to use cable cars to move their people back.
Just like us.
Just like us.
Yeah. Richard, stay with us. We're already at the top of the hour. We're going to come back. More discussions with Richard. I still got to find out why he thinks the Comet is an ancient spaceship. And then, of course, we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM.